CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 169, with Dr. Ed Anderson, practicing medicine across many continents and all about his interest in wildlife photography. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Ed Anderson from Durban, South Africa. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Uday. It's such an honor to do this podcast with you.
We're going to have fun talking.
I'm such a fan. I've learned so much from you over the years. And, I can remember the days when it was so difficult to get information about any new procedure. Right. And in those days we had Bobby Usher with his VHS tapes, which was fantastic.
Godfather.
In South Africa, we didn't get them that often, but they were fantastic. But now we've got such a range of, podcasts to choose from. So thank you for all you do for us.
Yeah, like you, we all learn together. And so I promise I learn way more than I contribute. The nice part was you put on an amazing Congress. That was a South African Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery meeting. It was just about 2 months ago, and I really enjoyed it. It's a very different meeting.
Thank you, Uday. I mean, it was a very special meeting, I've been doing the congresses for four years now. We've done two congresses. The one was in Durban and the other one is in Johannesburg. And it was such a special congress, this last one, especially because of our fantastic international speakers. And you were there.
Yeah, we had a great time. Well, I like that your approach to the learning was very kind of much more casual, a lot more in a discussion, a lot more interaction, and even a little bit of fun when Dan Reinstein and I did a pretend boxing match.
Yeah, when you do a congress, the first thing you've got to do is try and get a top scientific program. That is number one. And to get that, you've got to get some really good top international speakers. And this time we managed to get a number of top international speakers. We had you, we had Dan Reinstein, we had the people from ESCRIS, and that really made the scientific side. But with congresses, there's also got to be a little bit of fun. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a time to network, and you've got to try and make them a little bit of fun. And that's what we try to do. And then not just for the social events, but also for the, during the Congress with the debate with Dan Reinstein, which was just amazing. I mean, there was just so much energy in that room when you and Dan were debating. We've never had anything like that before. So thank you for doing that for us.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. As you know, Dan Reinstein and I were both also together at the previous 2011 SAS-CRS meeting in Durban.
Yeah, that's right. So it was about time you came back to us. I was very happy that you accepted my invitation. I wasn't sure because LA is a long way from South Africa. It's 24 hours flying time. So it was just fantastic that you agreed to come.
So we had just a great time, really great learning, great collegiality. Now, I was also impressed by just how hard ophthalmologists work in South Africa. So per the population, there are not that many ophthalmologists.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Our population is about 60 million. And we have about 450 ophthalmologists. So that makes about 8 ophthalmologists per million, people. And in the USA, I think it's about 50. I know that in India, it's about 15 per million. So South Africa is very low down in ophthalmologists. We're very short. So there's a lot of work, we just can't keep up with it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people that just don't get the service that they need. I listened to a podcast the other day for Ivan Gabrick, and he was talking about cataract surgery rates. Mm-hmm. And he said the cataract surgery rate in the USA is about 9,000 cataracts per million. Okay. But in South Africa, it is about 1 to 2,000. Per million. Wow. So we are doing a lot less cataract surgery per million people than you are doing in America. And I think in the UK, it's about 5,000 per million. So we are way behind. We've got a long way to go to catch up. We just don't have enough.
Right? And they also, I was impressed, the breadth, the scope of work. Like every ophthalmologist there basically has to do everything from a cataract surgery to a ruptured globe and everything in between.
Yeah. There are a lot of comprehensive ophthalmologists, but I think that's changing over the years. I think when I started in practice too, I used to do everything. You know, I used to do a bit of retina, even surgical retina, you know, cornea, cataracts, glaucoma, the whole works, oculoplastics. But over the years, you kind of lose some of that. You find that you can't be, you know, really good at everything. So you kind of narrow your focus a little bit. And I think that is a trend. So there are, you know, now these days we have a lot of, you know, specialist retinal surgeons, corneal surgeons, cataract and refractive. So it has narrowed down, but there's still a lot of, you know, general ophthalmologists, especially in the public hospitals where there's a lot of work. Yeah. Right.
You've had an amazing kind of life path as a physician working in so many different countries, but interestingly, it led you all the way back to home. Take us through your path, because I know before you did your ophthalmology training, you've been a GP in Canada, but we've got to hear the whole story.
Yeah, I've had an interesting life, I think. I've been, you know, very happy with the things I've been able to do. You know, I was the son of a sugar farmer. So I was brought up on a sugar farm, and that sort of did not really appeal. That lifestyle did not really appeal to me. I wanted something a little bit more, just different, you know. So I always had a passion for medicine. So I got into med school in Johannesburg, and that was great. And during my internship, a funny thing happened. So after, you know, graduating, we do our internship, and I did it at a hospital quite close to where we are. And during your internship, you rotate through the different specialties, okay? And there was an ophthalmology department in that hospital, but it wasn't really very well run. So nobody wanted to do ophthalmology. So it was my idea to put everyone's name in a hat and pull out a name, and that person would go through and do ophthalmology, that rotation. And as it happened, my name came out. So I was kind of forced into ophthalmology at that stage, but I developed a passion for it. And that, you know, took me to, you know, to go into ophthalmology. And I did my residence, my registrarship or residence training in Johannesburg as well. And but before that, I did do, you know, GP work. And I did some GP work in South Africa and as well as in Canada. And I found that it was difficult to be a GP because you know a little about a lot of things, but you don't have that focus that we have. So that kind of put me off a bit of GP, and I was very happy to fall into ophthalmology. And I went and did my, you know, primary exams in Edinburgh. I went and spent a few months there training. And I don't know if you know, in those days when you did your primary exam, the pass rate was very, very low. Maybe 20% of people passed. So you used to start in Edinburgh, you used to try the exam. If you failed, then you moved to Glasgow and you tried there. And if you, like a month later, then you'd move to Johannesburg, London, and try there. But luckily, I got through on the first attempt. So off I went to Canada, did a bit more GP work. And then after that, I came back to South Africa and started my practice. But I was lucky, I was able to, you know, practice overseas. So at the time, in the early 90s, it was the beginning of LASIK. And because of our one surgeon, Michiel Kritzinger, who introduced LASIK to South Africa, we were kind of the early starters for LASIK. We were in that early stage where LASIK was just getting going, and we had a number of surgeons doing it. And in England, Boots Clinics decided that, or Boots Optometrists decided that they wanted to open up LASIK clinics, and they were looking for surgeons. So I was lucky to be chosen as one of those surgeons. So I used to go over for between 2 weeks and a month every now and again, you know, for several years, and just do LASIK and all over the country. So I practiced from London to Glasgow, Edinburgh, Leeds, Manchester, Bristol, everywhere. It was just a fantastic experience. And Emmanuel Rosen was, the leader of that that cataract clinic. He was an amazing person. He was really a pioneer. And I remember, those early days with LASIK, we were using the Hansaterm. I'm not sure if you ever used the Hansaterm.
I did use it probably 20 years ago. Stressful.
And in South Africa, I wasn't using the Hansaterm. I was using, I think, one of the Moria keratomes. And I remember sitting in the laser clinic, which is like in Piccadilly Circus, like 50 meters from the statue with Emmanuel Rosen. And he was showing me on a patient how to use the Hansaterm. And yeah, so I became familiar with that. And it was a great experience. So that was the one experience, was doing LASIK in those early days.
Those microkeratomes were so stressful because for the younger surgeons now, every time you want to do a LASIK flap, you use a femtosecond laser. So it's just low stress. I performed LASIK in my own clinic yesterday. Everyone had a femtosecond laser flap. So easy. But the Hansaterm or the other kind of manual microkeratomes, wow, the stress. As that keratome went across the cornea, you just hoped when it returned. You just kind of never knew.
Well, you won't believe it, but we are still using the microkeratome, not the Hansaterm. We use the Moria One Use Plus, which is a big improvement. In our area and a lot of areas in South Africa, they're just not the amount of financial, people just have the financial means to pay for a femtosecond laser. So there are in Cape Town and Johannesburg, but in the other areas, there's still a lot of microkeratome use. And as you say, it is still a stressful thing. It never becomes not stressful.
Right.
those early days of LASIK were kind of a learning, there was a lot of things to learn about LASIK.
Right.
Stromal depth, we used to go down to 250 micrometers or even less than that.
Yeah.
And, we were using I think it was the ACS, automatic corneal shaper in those days, which was the first one, which was really giving you quite small flaps a lot of the time and free flaps, which you don't get anymore. So it was quite tough. And but it was a lot of fun, and it was a great experience to go through that whole evolution of LASIK. And I mean, even the topographers were kind of, there was no
orb scan, the original orb scan, remember?
Orb scans. I mean, yeah, we went through all of that. And I mean, Today we've just got so many more instruments, the anterior segment, OCTs, that are just great as well. So, it's come a long way.
It has. Now, in addition to all doing all that LASIK, you also even helped out the NHS with cataract backlogs.
Yeah, so in those days too, there was a big backlog of cataract surgery in the NHS, and one of the South African groups, one of the South African hospital groups called Netcare, brought a hospital group in England, and it was called the General Hospital Group or something like that, and they got a contract to do 40,000 cataracts. And again, they took a number of surgeons from South Africa, and I was lucky to be chosen to do that as well. And we traveled around in mobile clinics all over, from Brighton to, I think, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, I don't know where it was, but the whole of the country. And we worked in mobile clinics, and they're very efficient. We used to do 25 cataracts a day in this mobile clinic. Yeah, so it is high volume. And yeah, it was just the surgery, nothing else. The follow-ups and everything were done by other people. So that went on for about 4 or 5 years as well. So that was a great experience. Also just to see how the different systems work, to work in a different country. And yeah, we also, added a little bit of holiday on each time. So that was also fantastic. Yeah.
Right. And your travels also took you to doing ophthalmology a little bit in Dublin, and then also a little bit in New Zealand even.
Yeah, when in the early days too, I had a friend who had moved to New Zealand, and they were looking for a locum, and we were also just looking to see what New Zealand would be like to live. So I went and did, I spent about, I think it was a month or 6 weeks there. And that was in a little town called Whanganui, which is quite close to Wellington. And that was just an amazing experience as well, just to work in a hospital there and to explore the country. And I just remember my first list there. You know, when you go to a different theater, a different OR, everything's different. The microscope's different. The phaco machine's different. Everything's different. It's quite an adjustment to that first list. And I think I remember the first OR list that I had there. I went to go and wash my hands to scrub up, and I couldn't even turn on the taps. I didn't know that there was a sensor because in South Africa, you have those sensors to turn on. So that was a bad start, a little bit embarrassing. And I had a full day's list on my first list. And I think I finished it like, the phaco machine was a Cooper Vision or something like that.
Oh, wow. Different. Yeah.
Peristaltic pump or something like that I never used. So it was quite an adaption. I think I finished at 8 o'clock at night. So it was interesting, but it was a lot of fun. And then I also, I think, you know, Arthur Cummings, he moved to Dublin. I think you know Arthur quite well. Yeah. And I mean, he's a fantastic guy, fantastic surgeon. And he, you know, when he moved there and he took over the clinic, I think he built a really great name for himself because he's just such a great surgeon. And he got really, really busy. So he was looking for people to go and help him out, either as locum or long term. And I went over for locum and I did a little bit of work there. And that was just another amazing experience to go and work with Arthur and learn. I think when you go to any other person's, you know, you learn a lot.
For sure.
I mean, it just helps you. Many years ago, I went to ASCRS meeting in Boston. And then after that, I went to, with Howard Fine. I went to Howard Fine, to Eugenie in Oregon. And he was a real gentleman. And he, you know, loved to have you in theater. And I mean, he was a great guy. He used to actually come to South Africa quite a lot. And he actually did live surgery at some of our congresses. You know, he was one of the real pioneers of the early of cataract surgery in those days. So he was a great guy. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's been great. It's been a great journey, ophthalmology, but I always came back to South Africa.
You know, it's sometimes that's where your heart is. So if even I'm like you, my clinic today is 10 kilometers from my high school.
Oh, really?
I didn't travel too far. So you're kind of the same way. But you actually ventured out. I didn't do anything, any training in any of the countries. I'm 100% USA. In fact, all my training is here in California. And so, but you did all over the world, but yes, came back to where your heart is.
I think it's great to go out and experience, you know, other countries. I encourage my children to do that as well. Because I think you learn about the different systems, how they do things differently in different countries. Everyone does things a little bit different. It's been a great journey. Yeah,
there's so much to be learned, especially I think now, again, not just the surgical techniques that we show like on Cataract Coach, but even the little things of how they set up their operating room. Or I remember the first time I saw someone who had, they put tape on the floor so the nurse knew exactly where to put the pedals. And exactly where you put the gurney when you brought the patient in. So I was like, wow, that's a neat idea. I didn't even think of that.
You know, I watched your little Cataract Coach video about where you put your iPhone on the wall.
Oh, yes, for sure.
You videoed how you operate in your OR. And I think it's, I looked at that and I thought, that's very much the same as I do. Right. You know, it's a little bit different, but not that much different. You know, it made me feel good that we don't do things that much different.
Now you said before how we're kind of equalizing surgical education because now the whole world has video access and high def on their phone to any of these new surgical techniques. So I think the nice part there is that really it's become a lot more uniform.
Yeah, I think it has. I think that's a big factor. You know, those Cataract Coach videos, which shows people from all over the world. And I think it definitely helps to standardize, you know, surgery around the world. They're just fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the power of social media is just bonkers. I put a post up recently on my Instagram. And by the way, my Instagram is unbelievable. I mean, I'm like 2.1 million views a month. And it's only, there are no cute puppy videos on my Instagram. It's only ophthalmology. And so it's only ophthalmology seeing it. But it's just like, it's really become, oh, here, I'll show you. It's, yeah, here, last 30 days is 2.1 million views on Instagram. Nice person, I'll put up a poll. And I was like, you know, do you operate with the room lights on? Room lights on. Like in 24 hours, 600-700 surgeons vote. So you can like put something out there. Or I had a case once, I didn't know what was going on. So I put the video up and like, please leave a comment below. Someone help me here. And boom, you've got hundreds of ophthalmologists who will reply. Like the big massive like group learning is unbelievable now.
I think you have to be the most best known ophthalmologist in the world because of that. I mean, is there anyone who does not know, any ophthalmologist that does not know Uday Devgan? I don't think so.
I don't believe you. I'm not all that special. Just ask my kids. They'll say, Dad, you're nothing, please. But no, the nice part is, I think, you know, certainly there's so much to be learned. You know, we have a sister channel now, Retina Rounds, with my colleague, my retina specialist, Pradeep Prasad. I watch those videos. It's just so interesting to me. And I don't expect to ever do a crazy stuff like that. I'm not going to peel the ILM of a macula, but the way they do it, I just thought it was so neat. It's fascinating to me. I love to watch it.
Yeah, I watched the one, I think, the one about Steve Charles. I think he was one of, and I mean, Steve Charles came to South Africa many years ago, and we actually took him on safari as well. It wasn't a cataract and refractive surgery congress. It was one of our other congresses. And I just remember sitting with him at breakfast and him telling me his life, you know, his life, how he practices his life. Just an amazing person. He told me, you know, that he worked 7 days a week. Okay. He didn't believe in holidays. He hadn't taken a holiday for 25 years or something. He had no hobbies. He didn't play golf or anything. He said he lived alone in an apartment and surgery was his life. And he was also just flying jets, you know, around the country. And I'm just thinking, yeah, this guy has got so much passion for ophthalmology. I mean, how many people have got that? We've all got passion because that's why we're here. But how many people have got that much passion? And I mean, he's still operating today. He's still going flat out. I don't know how he does it, but he's been such a pioneer with retinal surgery. He's just an amazing person as well.
For sure. Ophthalmology has so many incredible people. So smart, so driven, so innovative that honestly, you'll laugh if I tell you, but I often have imposter syndrome. Like, these guys are so brilliant. I'm like, make up for my working really, really hard. But otherwise, like, no, it's we're blessed. It's an incredibly blessed field. Now, your sons aren't going to go into sugar farming, right?
No. So my sons are both ophthalmologists, or one's a qualified ophthalmologist, and the other one is writing his final exams in about 2 months' time. So they both went into ophthalmology. It's very special to me. It's not something I kind of encouraged, because parents are always wrong. If you'd encouraged it, they wouldn't have done that.
Parents are always wrong. That's true.
So some are, you know, I think it's kind of a lifestyle choice. I think they looked at, they've obviously been through all the specialties during their med school training. And I think they decided, yeah, maybe their dad, you know, made a good choice. And I think they've made a good choice now. So it's very special to have them. We've got a lot in common now. We've got a lot to talk about.
You're right.
And they are teaching me things now. You know, they are teaching me things.
For sure.
You know, for instance, we always did the old extracapsular type of procedures. And the other day I was watching my son doing a MSIC, you know, and I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And I've got to learn to do that. You know, I haven't been doing that. Not that I hardly ever need to do it, but I need to know how to do that. So, they are teaching me things. And if I've got to a difficult patient, you know, I will, you know, we communicate. They send me their cases and I send me, you know, we communicate about difficult things, difficult problems that we both have.
I think it's fantastic to have that in common. But you're right. The new generation is really quite special. They learned what took us 10 years to learn in the operating room. They can learn in 1 year. It's unbelievable. Because of all these videos, they can learn a complication, learn to recognize and manage a complication without actually experiencing it first. And
that makes a big difference. Because, I mean, they say, good judgment comes from experience, but experience comes from bad judgment. You don't have to go through that bad judgment stage if you can watch it on a video.
Right. So,
yeah.
And then there's so much to recognize. Even like today's cataract video was like a patient with bypass, but a little bit of zonulopathy, and then the guest surgeon, the anonymous surgeon, injected a whole AC full of tripan blue dye, which of course went through the zonulopathy, and now instead of a red reflex, he had a blue reflex. He had blue vitreous.
I saw that.
Oh. You learned, like, that. Don't do that. You know, next time.
I saw that. Yeah, that was interesting. I follow them on, I look at those videos on Instagram. I mean, they come fast and furious every day.
That's kind of my test for myself. I wanted to see, 8 years ago when I started this, I said, can I do a video a day? And I said, my one talent is I can just work hard. I'm not afraid of hard work. I like to work hard. And so I was like, okay. And I've kept it up. I haven't missed a day yet. But in fairness, I do have the next month already lined up in a queue.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but it takes a lot of discipline and planning, you know.
Yeah.
And efficiency. It's efficiency. I mean, just like your cataract surgery is so efficient. I mean, your video editing must be really efficient as well. Because, I mean, for me to edit a video, it takes like 2 days.
So as of today, I've edited and posted 2,888 videos. So I mean, I got it down to an art. What I do actually, I use a lot of macros basically, and then I also have kind of templates already pre-done. Okay. And so when it comes up with the words and the this and my intro sound and all, that's kind of already just self-populates right off the bat, and so that saves a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where you get the time to travel around the world. And
that's the fun. That's the fun, I tell you.
And then go back and then operate and see patients and then do the videos in between this. I mean, I don't know how you do it, but yeah, it's amazing.
It's a great team. That's the trick. When I came back from South Africa, I really had a great time, but then I came back, how did I work so hard? my team had just booked it solid. Like, you were gone. You missed 2 surgery days. We need to like lay it on thick. So we
I think that's a problem when you go away. You know, the work accumulates. And the thing about our practices now is because we still do, I still do medical retina.
Sure.
And every, you know, week there are a lot of patients requiring anti-VEGF injections. So when you go away and you miss a week or two, you come back and you spend the whole they're just doing anti-VEGFs because you got to catch up with those. So that takes a lot of time, you know. So, yeah, that's, you know, a lot of us are not just cataract and refractive surgeons. You know, we also still do quite a bit of the other stuff. We moved away from, you know, the surgery for retina, and we don't do oculoplastics anymore. Still do a lot of glaucoma and MIGS and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a pretty general practice, yeah.
I think given the numbers we were talking about earlier, I think you just kind of have to. And then in South Africa, there's really just such a huge need.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. And we need to produce more ophthalmologists, basically. We're only producing there's basically about 100, 120 maybe residents in training at in one stage. So you're only getting about 25, you know, new ophthalmologists every year. So it's not really catching up. You know, there's probably that many retiring every year as well. So there's just not enough. And obviously the aging population, it's not really keeping pace, in other words, yeah.
Right. I mean, if you have enough interest, I'd be interested to look at the stats. If you have more people interested and ophthalmologists that are applying. Like if there are 25 spots per year and you have 50 applicants, well, maybe just increase to like 40 spots, you know?
Yeah, it should be. I think in South Africa, you know, money is a problem. They struggle to find the budget for that. And that's really holding it back. So yeah, we've got a long way to go.
But even the young generation, there's only so efficient they can be. I mean, I'm sure they can, you know, with a lot of help, do 100 cataracts a day. But that takes its toll on your body, your brain.
We're waiting for that robotic surgery. You know, that just looked amazing.
It's going to be a brave new world. But you know what it is? It's just like excimer laser. You know, before we did radial keratotomy. I've never done one, but I've seen radial keratotomy for treatment of keratorefractive, you know, myopia. That was very hand dependent, very sort of dependent. And then now you move to LASIK. And now, even if you look at like trans PRK, you literally step on a pedal. It's surgical judgment is what you're using, though. So I don't ever want to go back to the PRK days. So I think when you have a robot the robot's going to help you do so much of the surgery, it's not a bad thing.
No, it's not. No, I think like we look back now at the old days, you know, doing large incision extracapsular extraction. Nice. And, you know, my kids will look back to this day and say, we were still doing phaco manually, you know, it won't be like that. There'll be so many other inventions to come. And I mean, robotic surgery is obviously just starting, but it's coming. I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's going to be quicker than we think, probably.
I think so. And I think it evolves very, very quickly. I mean, look at the phaco machine you used back, your old Cooper Vision machine, or for me, the first one I used, the Alcon 10,000. Yeah. Wow, compare that to what you're using now. Like, it's unbelievable. Night and day difference.
It is. The hand pieces were heavy. The probe was very large. The fluidics hadn't been worked out.
Right.
The energy, you know, the energy that you used to put into the eye with those machines was immense, you know, compared to what you get now. So yeah, we're very lucky. Yeah.
And I think the same thing will happen certainly with the robotic side. The other thing too is right now we're having the robot emulate us. But I sit temporal or someone sits superior because that's access.
Yeah.
Right? You're just kind of limited by my surgeon hand's ergonomics. Well, if you don't have that limitation.
Absolutely.
If you don't, I only have two hands, but the robot can have three or four hands, no problem.
Yeah.
So do we then change the whole idea of how should we do the surgery? Maybe it's something so super different. Maybe it's not anything like we're doing it now. So who knows how it'll evolve?
It's an evolution that we can't even think of. And maybe the AI will think of it. Yeah, they will. It'll work something out.
Right, right. Yeah, even that's getting better and better now. Because now, you know, it's interesting. I end up using Google Gemini to do certain tasks, help me write an outline for something. And a lot of times if I ask a very, very specific topic, let's talk about like a loose lens, iris, diaphragm, and pseudoexfoliation or something, it'll write something for me that's really actually at least 90% right. And then I ask what the sources were. And the crazy part is like now half the sources are YouTube videos that it has made a transcript of and used to learn, including cataract coach videos. Because YouTube is owned by Google.
Okay.
So it's wild.
Yeah, I found that ChatGPT, you know, is great. But you also just got to double check some things. You know, it's not always right. It definitely is not always right. I'll give you an example just from today. Tomorrow we're having a whole lot of people for lunch. And my wife's cooking a leg of lamb, and I said to ChatGPT, we're having 8 people tomorrow. How many kilograms of meat do we need of a leg of lamb? And it said to me, you need 0.5 kg per person. Okay, so for 8 people, you need 4 kgs of leg of lamb. And I went to another source. I went to Jamie Oliver. Okay. How many for 8 people? He says, no, you need about 2 kgs. So 2 kgs, you know, we would have this massive leg of lamb and then some for 8 people. So, yeah, you just can't trust it, even for little simple things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it needs a little more scrutiny. I'm with you on that. But boy, the rate at which it's evolving is unbelievable. It's just better and better and better.
Yeah, we're just hoping, especially for the, you know, in South Africa, we've got a very range, big range of cataracts, because a lot of people present very late. You know, you get a lot of mature cataracts, really white cataracts, and orange cataracts, really. And you never know. Those are the difficult ones that you shouldn't really be doing. Sometimes you get into trouble if you're trying to do phaco in those cases. So it would be nice to be able to have AI tell you what to do with those cases. Because sometimes you have a mature cataract and you can do a phaco. It's not a problem. They can be quite soft, but others can be really terrible. So you need some way of measuring the density and making a decision, helping you make a decision about what procedure to do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those types of cataracts, I think you're right. There's some that you can phaco pretty easily. But even in badly ills, I'm like your sons. Once a month, I'll do an M6 case. Just because it's less stress for me. And the amazing part is, the corneas are just clear the next day, which is just like, wow. And for these really brunescent, these ones that are the color of Coca-Cola, like really dark brunescent.
Yeah.
Those are just tough.
I think they become experts in that, because the first 200 cases, that's what they're doing. Before they even touch a phaco, they've got to do like 200 or 300 M6, and then they move on to phaco. So they get a lot of surgical experience. You know, they probably do in their residency, they probably do 500 or 600 phacos during their residency. So they come out quite proficient, you know. But I think, you know, when you finish your residency, it's only the beginning of your learning curve. You still got a lot. You know, you can never just be think that you've mastered cataract surgery, because there's always something different. I mean, after, I'm sure like you, me, I've done tens of thousands of cataracts, and you still have some cases that are really difficult.
Right.
And you learn, you know, every time you go to a congress, every time you watch a video, you learn. So, you know, it's a continuous learning process. You'd never get over that learning. I think, being a surgeon, you just got to accept that. You're never going to stop learning.
That's true. Yeah. You'd lifelong learning for sure. I mean, I still remember I was so naive. I was so dumb. I finished a couple hundred cases in residency, and then I thought, gosh, I'm ready for the world. I'm so good. Boy, did I get humbled the next few hundred cases.
Yes.
You just get humbled, like, whoa, I don't know as much as I think.
And I mean, these days, you know, cataract surgery is really refractive surgery.
Right.
So there's that whole learning as well. When you kind of come out of residency, the patients in the public hospitals are not as demanding as when you go into private practice. When you're in private practice, they really are demanding. Sure. So they are expecting amazing outcomes. So there's a lot to learn about that. You know, you don't chuck unhappy patients. You just got to get over that learning curve, but you never really get over it, because you can never get everything right. You know, you're still going to have unhappy patients. I think patients tend to judge you not on your surgical skill, but on what your refractive result is. So if they are going for plano and you end up plus 0.75 or plus 0.5, you know, they may not be happy with that, even though they were like plus 3 before or something like that. So yeah, it's quite a challenge at times, as you know, to get that right.
It's meeting expectations. You know, one thing I do miss, when I used to do half time or half professor at UCLA, half my own private practice, and I retired from doing my professor duties a few years ago, and I really miss those sweet kind of county hospital patients, which is kind of like your public hospital, where they're. Yes. Everything is just, they're just happy. They're just coming with a brunescent cataract. Okay, they end up 20/60. Maybe they've been to plus one or minus one. They just love you. They're so grateful. And then you go to private practice, and they can literally be plano in 20/20, and they'll say to you, but when's it going to be sharp again?
Yes.
What do you want from me?
Exactly. Don't you just love the patients that, you know, as you said, you bring them down from plus 3, and they get 20/20. And they play no, and you say to them, how's your eye? And they say, oh, it's fine. That's not the way to that's not the adjective to describe the result. You know, they should say it's fantastic, it's wonderful, what an amazing job. But you don't get the response a lot of the time. You just say, oh, they're fine, it's fine. And that really makes me mad. But you do get some very happy patients. And when you get a happy patient, whether it's a cataract op after a cataract op, and especially LASIK patients, because it changes their lives. Oh, so that is the great thing about, you know, our profession is we are changing people's lives. And I think that makes it addictive. You know, I think we get a dopamine rush to our brain, you know, when we get that sort of result. And it's quite addictive to, I think we'd miss that if you had to stop surgery, you'd actually miss that a lot.
Oh, for sure. Not only the fun of surgery, but also the fun and the excitement and the love you get on gratitude on post-op day one. Like, I can't ever have someone else see my post-op day one patient because I want that love.
Exactly right. You don't want to miss out on that.
Right. That's half the fun. Now, it was also very impressive to you that you travel a lot, like, I mean, dozens of countries. And you're also a very avid photographer. You tell us about that.
Yeah, we'd love to travel. We've always traveled, even when my kids were small. We used to travel. We used to take them all over the world. It started when I was a kid, actually. My parents took me overseas a few times, and that got the bug in us. So we've always traveled a lot. You know, we've been to many, many countries. And we love it. So in particular, we like wildlife. So we go to a lot of wildlife places. So, you know, recently we've been to the Antarctic, you know, which was phenomenal to see all the penguins and the whales, etc., and the walruses. And then last year we went to the Arctic, you know, to Svalbard, where we saw the polar bears and a lot of birds. And for instance, we've been to Uganda to see the gorillas and the chimpanzees, which is phenomenal. They're just amazing because they're quite friendly. You get very close to them, even though they're wild. We've been to India to see the tigers. We've been to Brazil to see the jaguars. So that's my wife, Pam, you know her, she loves that. So that's part of the reason we go. My passion is birds and bird photography. So that's kind of a more specific focus of my wildlife travel. And, you know, I love photography. I think as ophthalmologists, we're all geeks and we love images. You know, we photograph everything we can. We take these amazing topography pictures. Right. We do anterior segment scans. We do OCTs of the macula. We photograph the iris. We love photographs. We love images. And that's kind of spread, you know, to me, to my general photography. So I spend a lot of time trying to photograph birds. And in South Africa, we have a very good, lot of diversity of birds. We have about 1,000 birds. And I really started during COVID. We had a lot of time. So I started counting birds and going out and looking for different birds. So far I've done about close to 700 birds photographed in South Africa. But the last 300 are the difficult ones, you know, the more rare ones. You never actually see every bird. So, I mean, birding photography, or birding in general, is kind of a growing tourism around the world. And in where I live, there's a guy who started off as an accountant, and he got bored with that, as you can imagine. And then he started doing tourism for birding. And he now has the biggest birding tourism company in the world.
Wow.
People in every country in the world that do birding, and he's seen like probably 8,000 birds. So I mean, there are some fanatics. I read a book recently. There's this lady called Phoebe Snitzinger, I think. She was an American, and she came from quite a wealthy family. And at the age of 50, about 50, she got diagnosed with malignant melanoma. So she thought, in my last days, I want to see as many birds as I can in the world. So she started traveling and photographing birds all over the world. And eventually she was the first person to get over 8,000 birds in the world. And she neglected her family, unfortunately, you know, because of this obsession. Right. And eventually, she actually lived for an extra 15 or 18 years after the diagnosis. So she actually had a lot of time to do this. So she was expecting to die, but she didn't. But she eventually died when her vehicle overturned in Madagascar. But wow. That was somebody who has really got an obsession, you know? So there are people like that.
Right, you can be obsessed with birding, or you can be obsessed with retina surgery, right?
Yeah, but, so
I understand. Yeah. I mean, the eye is basically a camera, right? So, no wonder so many ophthalmologists are into photography. I mean, we deal with optics every day, that's what we do.
We do. I mean, we've got so much imaging in our practices these days, it's just amazing,
right? Yeah. So, I mean, you always tell professionals, I whip out my cell phone camera and you've got the professional glass, like, well, that's some fancy glass.
Yeah. The equipment is expensive. It's a bit like ophthalmic equipment. It is expensive. You know, those big lenses, but they are amazing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's become popular, photography in general, because the cameras, you know, have just become so good and the lenses have become so amazing. So even an amateur who does not do a lot of photography can get amazing pictures these days. You know, it's a great hobby. Yeah.
So for the Arctic, you said you went through Svalbard, so Norway.
Yes.
And for the Antarctic, you did Argentina then, or how did you? I have not been.
To get to the Antarctica, you basically go to Ushuaia, okay, which is the southern tip of Argentina, and then you get in a boat, and then you go across you go across to Antarctica. But if you go on that sort of trip and you like wildlife, you first go to the Falkland Island.
Okay.
And then you go, because there's a lot of great wildlife there. But the highlight really is South Georgia, which is an island or group of islands a little bit south of the Antarctic, but it's where most of the wildlife is. When you go to the Antarctic itself, it's pretty white and calm and deserted, and it's beautiful, but there's not a lot of wildlife. There's a few penguins, but most of the wildlife is on South Georgia. Mm. So, So when you come back, well, the thing about going to Antarctica, if you get seasick, it's a bit of a problem, because you have to go across the Drake Passage, which is sort of a circumpolar current that goes clockwise around the pole. And it is the roughest sea. Okay. So if you look at some YouTube videos of that and you see some of the horrendous waves that they have to go through, but it does vary. But I mean, we went through it. It wasn't bad, so we were very lucky. We didn't get seasick. But yeah, it's an amazing experience. There is actually an easier way to get to the Antarctic now. There's actually a flight from Cape Town.
Wow!
That flies to the Antarctic. It's a company called Ultima. And they fly you in, it's not a luxurious plane, it's like a army transport plane. It's about a 5-hour, 6-hour flight, and you land on the ice, and then you can spend a few days there. They've got amazing accommodation there. And then they fly you in another small plane to go and see the emperor penguins, which are the really, they're the big penguins. They're the king of penguins. So you get a lot of different types of penguins, but the emperor penguin is like the big one. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Happy Feet, which is a Disney movie. And, it's quite a fun movie for kids, and it's about the emperor penguins. So that you can do from Cape Town. The only thing, it's really expensive. I think it costs like $30,000.
Oh, wow.
To go there for about three or four days. I mean, that's only 3 Beverly Hills cataracts, but still.
But no, it sounds like an absolutely amazing adventure.
Yeah, it is. So there are just so many amazing places in the world to see. I think I counted, I've been to 67 countries, but there are 200 countries in the world. And I think, I mean, you've lectured in 60-something countries, haven't you?
I've done a lot. Yeah. I don't know if there's an Antarctic Ophthalmology Congress. If there is, please invite me. I'm coming.
We could always arrange one.
It's fun. I love to learn from colleagues. If you invite me to a country, I'm coming. I want to come see. I want to enjoy. As you know, your kind of priorities change. Second half of life, after age 50, I'm here to really maximize the enjoyment.
Yeah, me too. I think you start realizing that you are mortal, and you got to take a little bit of time for yourself. You know, it's not all. You can still keep your passion, but I think you got to have a little bit of me time. You know, I think it's life. You know, the life work balance. You know, that's what it's all about. I think life work balance is a bit overrated. In your early life, you know, the balance is very much towards work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you come out of residency and you've been studying, or your colleagues have been working for, or your schoolmates have been working for more than 10 years, and you are just starting. You've got an old car. You have delayed gratification for such a long time. You just want to make a little bit of capital and get a new car and maybe buy a house or something like that. So your balance is very much towards work. You know, but as you get older, that changes and the balance shifts to the other side. You know, that you still want to work, but you've got to have a little bit of need time for yourself as well. You've got to enjoy your life.
I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely. You had a great session that you put on the Sunday, the last day of your meeting, your Congress in Johannesburg, which was kind of every speaker kind of giving a 5-minute of just give me your best pearls about surgery, about life, about anything. That was so useful. Tell our audience a little bit about that session. It was a great idea.
Yeah, we call it the top tip session. And I kind of stole that idea from the Asia Pacific cataract and refractive surgery. They have a similar session. So I went to, you know, one of their congresses, because I went to a number of congresses to get speakers before our congresses. And I thought that was a great idea. And we did it at our previous one in Durban, and it was just phenomenal. Everyone enjoyed it, so I kind of did it this time. So it's a nice session. It gets people to the Congress on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry, on the Sunday when it's the last session. And because often Sunday is deserted. People come the first 2 days and then they get tired of it. Mm-hmm. But you get a lot of people to that session. They love their top tips. And I mean, you gave a really great tip as you know, I think you gave a really good thing about, what was it, about the stages of your life or something like that?
Yeah. I had two pearls. I have to do something surgical. So my quick first pearl was how to do the twist and out IOL exchange, how to explant the lens. But my other one was kind of just stuff you learn the hard way, which is life ends up being a zero-sum game. So if you're flying high and everything seems great right now, enjoy it, because tough times are coming. And similarly, if you're down in the dumps right now and you just... Yeah, hang in there, because good times are around the corner. At the end, I promise it's all zero sum. It all evens out.
Yeah, I really liked that tip. I really thought it was amazing. Yeah, that was excellent. But I think that the thing about you today is that you bring so much energy when you give your talks. I mean, I think you've got that gift.
Right.
You've got a great gift. You like to talk to people. And I mean, you just bring this whole energy, and that energy when we did that debate, you know, there's never been anything like that at any other Congress I've ever seen. The people were so excited about it. They talk about it. Right. They said it was the best Congress we've had. So it was amazing. And I mean, Dan Reinstein is also, you know, amazing. Really good. He's got a lot of stories to tell and he's really funny. So yeah, he was fantastic too. Yeah, we had a lot of great speakers. The ESRS were great in bringing the academy. I mean, they really have been great for us because they bring some great speakers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we added on a few others like Ben LaHood and David Gunn. And they had an amazing lot of international speakers. And in fact, there were 25 international speakers.
Wow.
at our last Congress, which is good because South Africa is not easy to get to, and it's a long way for a lot of people to come. It's not just like, you know, a quick trip. It's like a lot, you know, often connecting flights to get there. Yeah, so we really appreciate it because it gives exposure to especially the young ophthalmologists. They haven't got the money to travel, to go to international congresses. You know, it's great for them because, yeah, they've got a lot to learn, and to get international exposure is just phenomenal for them. So
your next one will be then in 2 years, so 2028 is the next
one. That's going to be in Cape Town. So maybe you'll come there because maybe you need to come to Cape Town again.
our audience is worldwide. If you want a beautiful trip to South Africa, Cape Town would be a gorgeous place. And this is a meeting that I promise you will just love. I go to a lot of meetings in a lot of countries every year. This is a very special meeting. You'll have a great, absolutely great time and learn a ton. So definitely, if you reach out to Ed, we'll put a link down below. But if you're interested, 2028, Cape Town. You'll have a great time.
Yeah, look, Cape Town is our main international city. And people love Cape Town. I mean, it's just got so much going for it. We've got great restaurants, it's a beautiful place. It's a bit like Rio de Janeiro, you know, it's a beautiful place. And everyone's heard of Cape Town. Not many people have heard of Durban. That's a little bit, not as well known. Johannesburg, they may know, but Cape Town's up, you know, it's more easier to get people to come to Cape Town because they, you know, that they will enjoy it there.
Yeah, and the penguins. I saw the penguins there.
Yeah, you saw the penguins, the African penguins.
Right.
Yeah, they're very special. They are threatened as well. A lot of penguins are threatened because they were getting bird flu and a lot of them were dying. Even in Antarctic, there were thousands of penguins that were dying from bird flu. So, travel is great, and I mean, every time I look, you're in a different country. So,
I always debate: do I put pictures of my trip while I'm on the trip, and then people are like, no, I'm not home, or do I wait till I get back home and then post the trip? I haven't figured that out yet.
Everyone can see your passion for ophthalmology. You definitely got that passion if you're going.
You know, I think we all do. Well, Ed, can you imagine? We've been just chit-chatting for an hour already. Time
flies. Really?
Yeah, it's been, looking at the clock, it's been an hour. Wow. How easy is that? That was just a fun conversation. But I think I really, really enjoyed your Congress. You did an incredible job. I got to say thank you to your wife, Pamela. The events that she did were spectacular. Like, really, like no other Congress. So...
thank you. I mean, she loves to do that. She's done a number of the congresses now. She is a perfectionist at that, and she stresses about it, but it always works out so well. So I'm very lucky to have her. She supports me, and I'm very grateful for that. So,
For sure. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time for this podcast. I really appreciate it. We'll put a link down below for the South African side of cataract refractive surgery. Definitely put it on your maps and your radar for 2028, 2 years from now, if you want an incredible trip. Definitely go. I think it'd be an amazing time.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor. So thank you.
Thank you. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you're going to find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. At the time of this video, we're probably getting pretty close to 3,000 videos. There's still a new one every day. So until next time, I'll catch you later.